What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your whip in it now. Fill your body up tight. Walk it hard and long. When you finish that,
the hip knocker.
Episode 165 of the Talking Bollocks podcast, brought to you by Go Loud. It's me, COB.
It's me, Teddy Flower.
And today we're joined by
Colin Judge.
Colin, thanks for coming into us.
How's things? How are you keeping?
All good, sir.
All good.
Very happy to be here.
No, yeah. Thanks for coming in, especially with the bleeding weather today.
That was shocking. Sorry. Got stuck in the snow. The wheelchairs are not good in the snow.
Fucking hell, boys.
Not made for it.
Genuinely, what's the crack with that? Woke up this morning and said, what's going on here? Yeah.
Met Aaron, put out a thing, and they were like, if we had a crystal ball, we could have got it right and all. And we're like, you was at a one responsible for giving us a heads up here.
The boys are trying to tell us the weather on Mars.
Yeah.
And you say you need a crystal ball to tell us the weather in Dublin.
In Glasnevin, yeah.
Are you having a blade laugh?
So,
Colin, I heard that you have a zinger.
A zinger, yeah. I've got a good one for you.
Go on. I'm a bit nervous now.
It's been a long time.
You came prepared, and I don't like when a guest comes prepared.
This is the only bit of preparation that I have.
Right.
Everything else is off the cuff.
It's the most important preparation, I'd say.
Right.
Would you rather have your arms or your legs? Two arms and no legs, or no arms and two legs?
I'd say arms. I'd rather have arms.
Mm.
Because I feel like the prosthetics with legs is much more simple and advanced than where we are with arms, because you need to be able to close your hand. Whereas, like, I know I had a teacher who had a leg amputated, and he had a prosthetic leg. And now I know that was only one leg, but he looked all right. And if he went to rehab, he would have been able to learn to walk again on it. And I know, and there are people out there with prosthetic legs, and they're running marathons,
like myself.
They're running marathons, so like,
yeah.
Whereas I think I'll give it about another, say, 10 years time. I reckon the arm will be there. Don't they have like a Neuralink arm now where, like,
yeah, if you coming into play, yeah.
If you think not about closing your hand and gripping things, you can do it. And I'm like, that's
unbelievable.
Terminator shit that is.
Yeah.
I'd rather have my arms.
Yeah, same reasons.
Yeah, for them exact points there. Mm. Usually I try and play devil's advocate, but I'm like, no, good point, mate. That's my co-host.
Yeah.
Good point.
But yeah, I think, you know, I'd agree with you. Like, I have one arm and no legs. But like, there's guys on the tour with just one leg. And, you know, they're more able than me in a lot of ways. So it's kind of like, you know, they can walk, obviously, they can run, they can go up steps. They've learned how to write nearly, you know, the way.
Yeah. You learn how to adapt, isn't it, though?
Yeah, you do.
It's like, look at Christy Brown.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, he was able to move his left foot, and he's a world famous artist.
Yeah.
From being able to paint. You know what I mean? It's crazy with just his left foot. You have another one, do you?
I do have another one, actually, yeah.
Go
this
on.
Is like from my perspective.
Oh, here we go.
Do you think I'd rather have...
I don't like when you start
have
that.
My limbs back, have two arms and two legs, or win a gold medal at the Paralympics.
You take
gold
the medal
all day.
Yeah.
All day.
The only way I know is...
I reckon if you were to pull like an able-bodied athlete and said to them, would you give your arms and legs for a gold medal this summer, they'd probably say yeah.
Yeah.
That's how obsessed people get with it. Like, it's crazy.
That's a good way to
And think. Are you obsessed with it?
I love it.
Yeah.
I'm living the dream.
Yeah.
I'm full-time table tennis player, training with my coach, Sam, over there. It's obviously a very exciting year ahead, you know, with the Paralympics on the horizon in September. And I've got a good few events on the lead-up to the Games. I'm currently 9th in the world at the moment, and I'm really trying to get into the top 8 for the seeding to give myself the best chance of a medal. And we're getting kicked off next weekend. Actually, we're going to Spain on tomorrow week. And
is that like for a training camp?
Exciting. No, it's my first competition of the year.
Oh, so straight
I've
in.
I've had a long enough training period now since the end of November. So I'm really looking forward to getting back to it.
I am absolutely shy at table tennis.
It's harder than it looks, I told you.
Shy.
But you go around telling everyone you're great at it.
You have to blame, give yourself the blame, big Charlie. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I was telling Colin earlier, I'm off here. We were playing in the back page one night, me and all the boys, and we were acting the bollocks, and they do a tournament down there, and you win a couple of points if you win it. And my two brothers, Jared and Gav.
Yeah, very good, yeah.
Very, very good at table tennis. They are very good. It's madness. So we were all playing one night, and they said, right, the tournament is starting. And I don't know what ended up happening, but either Jared or Gav got to the final,
Aaron has twin brothers as well.
Yeah, he was telling me. Twins, yeah.
And they're both little. It's mad. And they look the same. So it's so weird.
So like, who's winning?
Even though I don't know who's who when they're doing them. Like, what the fuck is going on? But anyways, I'm 90% sure. I'll be corrected anyways after. But I'm sure one of them got to the final. But this fella stepped up and he said, I'm in for the final or for the game or whatever. And he goes, and I'm going to play with my phone. And we were like, yeah, obviously, you're going to be whipped, like. And he absolutely whitewashed him, 11-0, with his phone. How can you be that good at table tennis?
And
I don't know if I'm that good, but I definitely need to call down to this back page.
Yeah.
It's in Phibs for it.
Yeah. I know of it. I just haven't been there.
You've heard of the little tournaments they do.
I have, yeah.
Go in there and let's hustle everybody.
Absolutely, yeah. In a wheelchair and all. Like,
oh, yeah. Put some money down. Take out your own paddle then. You're like, oh, fuck.
Little customised job.
That's how you know people are. You're in trouble. Siobhan, our producer, sent us on a good thing. Right.
There we go.
So would you rather go back and sit your leaving cert today, so that's 1 week with one or two exams a day, so like the normal leaving cert, or go back to junior infants for a whole year, Monday 9 to 12, mostly just colouring and playing with blocks? I'd go back to junior infants in a happy. I wouldn't sit that leaving cert again.
I wasn't a huge fan of the leaving cert now, I have to say.
I still have nightmares over that. I can describe it so vividly. I'm in school, all my classmates are there, I know exactly who's there, and it's weird because I know what they look like now, and I do chat to some of them. But it's them when we were 18, 17, 18, 19, sitting the leaving cert. They're all there. I'm not prepared. They're all prepared, ready to rock. I'm like, I didn't know we have an exam today. I didn't know it was the leaving cert. I hadn't studied. And they're like, well, you have to sit. Like, you're here. You're going in that door now. You're sitting the exam. And I wake up petrified. And that was 12 years ago this year, I sat the leaving cert. And it still haunts me.
You told me that a couple of years ago. Obviously, I haven't sat the leaving cert, so it's stupid for me to answer the question. But you told me that a couple of years ago. And I seen a thread on Twitter then, being like, someone put up a tweet asking if anybody else gets these nightmares. And the person explained their nightmares. And the amount of people that agreed.
Have the same experience.
The same experience of people are traumatised over the test. What story was that?
I think because I remember the day we went into fifth year, first day in fifth year, we done transition year.
Yeah, so we did too, yeah.
Yeah, so it's just basically doing nothing for a year.
It's a great year.
Yeah. Nothing for the whole year. Then you walk into fifth year and you think like, all right, we'll ease into this. And they're like, no, we're already behind schedule. I'm like, what do you mean we're behind schedule? It's in 2 years. Not this year, it's next year. And they're like, we're behind schedule. You need to do this, you need to do that. And the pressure that's on you. And you're like, oh. And then like the point system, and then when your results come out and you're like, do I have to repeat, will I get into college? And you're sitting and you're waiting for their college offers to come in and all, and you're like, oh, and the pressure, and you're 18 years of age. Crazy, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm. It was tough back in the day. I think the kids these days now have it a lot better, you know, especially during the COVID times.
Oh, where you were just like
the predictive grades.
You were like, you're stoned. There's 600 points for you.
Exactly.
Yeah. Crazy, Carrie.
Yeah, unbelievable.
That actually happened, didn't it? They did predictive grades.
Yeah. Fellas who wanted to be like a personal trainer, now they're doctors. Neurosurgeons and all. Like, I just wanted to like lift a few kettlebells to, like, right in there and do a brain operation on them. Oh, fella, like, what are you picking, Terry? You going back to junior infants?
Yeah, well, I have to, yeah.
You don't have to. You can try the leaving cert if you want.
Well, you do want to try the leaving cert one day, actually.
Don't do it.
Don't do it.
I don't think probably it's changed a lot, though, hasn't it? It's kind of, it's a bit more.
I think it's more applied now, isn't
applied,
it?
Yeah. Do, I think that's a good thing.
More projects.
Yeah.
I think they're doing it with, like, less you're not pressure. Doing it for 100%. An ambition or a future goal. You're just doing it to do it. I think it's different. Do you get me? So I think if you're 17, 18, you probably think my whole future depends on this.
Yeah.
Maybe I won't go into college. There's a course I have in mind and all these things playing in your mind. But if you're actually just going to do it and it's actually not an essential part of your life or your future, I think it wouldn't be traumatic.
No, 100%. But it's played as this be all and end all. Like, if you fuck this up, you're gone.
Yeah.
That's what's played out to be. Like,
game over.
Yeah. What are you picking?
I'd go back to junior infants.
Everyone's
like, fuck that.
40 years of age, I'm going back to play with blocks.
Yeah. If anyone else out there has a similar experience to Calvin, let us know, because I'm actually intrigued by how many people are traumatised by a fucking test.
The time would probably go quicker, a year in junior infants.
Yeah.
2 weeks leaving, sir.
Yeah.
It goes on forever, doesn't it?
Yeah. Do you know what? It's actually mad when you think of the structure overall. Like, you're doing like maths today, and then like you could have a French exam in the afternoon, and then tomorrow you've English and and Irish, and you're like, right. And then the day after that, you have the mats paper two, and you're like, oh, I'm back to mats again. And you're like, give the kids the best chance. You should do like Monday, mats for everyone in the country.
Yeah, yeah.
Tuesday, English, everyone in the country. Mm. None of this breaking her up. Remember the one year they fucked her up? They gave someone out the wrong paper and then everyone had to repeat it.
I remember that, yeah. Remember that?
What?
Imagine if you did well in that paper.
You'd be fuming, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
They have like a chest full of all the exams at the top of the class. And I don't know, she was supposed to give out French, but she gave out like English or something like that. And like, so everyone else in the country didn't know what's on that exam, but everyone in that classroom did. So they had to take it back, do out a whole new test, and everyone had to come in on a new day to do that test.
And it was well after, I think, the leaving cert was over.
Yeah.
Oh, that is madness.
Because one person made a mistake. But like in college, you've obviously been to college as well. You do projects, and that project, you'll do an exam at the end of the semester, but the project will count for like 40% overall. Yeah. So you could walk into that exam already passed. Do you know what I mean? And that's, the leaving cert should be more like that, because it teaches you then how to, it teaches you structure and deadlines and stuff, instead of being like, the leaving cert's in 2 weeks, I'm going to cram this essay in and learn it word for word and then be able to put that back down on the page and then I'm going to pass. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But we're not spending a lot of time talking about leaving certs.
Yeah. Right, so we'll jump into you, Colin. If you want to take us back to the start, where you're from, what life was like growing up for you?
Yeah, so I was born in Blackrock, like I was telling you.
I said earlier on, you come from money then.
Yeah. Usually when the guest tells us where they're from, we'd always say like, oh, sorry to hear because it's funny. Then we'd be like, but like, fair play to you.
Well done. Yeah. Must be nice, is it?
No, Blackrock was all right. But I was born with one arm and no legs. And I was the first one born in Ireland with my condition. So that obviously hit my parents and the doctors pretty hard. They'd no idea, like my mum was a nurse and they'd done all the scans and, you know, nothing showed up. So it was a big, big shock. And, you know, the doctors, they weren't prepared for it. And, you know, they were telling my mum and dad, you know, that I was going to need full-time care my entire life. And I made out a list of things that I'd never be able to do. And it was really tough, I'd say, for them at the start. I obviously wasn't really aware of my disability at this stage. Like I went to St. Michael's College, like I said, from the junior school up into the senior school. And I wasn't really aware of my disability at this stage. And, you know, I was just kind of getting on with things. And, you know, I remember my mum, though, never let my disability get in the way. Like she used to leave my shirt and tie out on the bed every morning, you know, even though she knew there was no chance in hell that I could put it on myself. And I'm just kind of very grateful to her for that, you know, for making me exercise that muscle of trying something, failing at it and trying again, because it's definitely stood to me later in life and even in my teenage years then, which were obviously a lot more difficult dealing with my disability when I did realize that I was very different. But yeah, I think in my earlier years, I wasn't aware of my disability and, you know, I probably progressed, you know, a lot slower than most kids, but I was happy enough and I didn't really know any different. Like, but yeah.
Would you call that tough love from your ma?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I wasn't really aware of it back then, but I'm just kind of, because I probably got frustrated, you know, and especially the tie. I still struggle with the tie.
Yeah, I can't deal with tie.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not easy. one hand, you know. But yeah, it was frustrating at the time, you know. You just want to be as independent as possible, or I did anyway. And, you know, I think it was maybe good that I went to an able-bodied school, you know, for that reason, kind of, I just wanted to be like my friends, I suppose. And, you know, then that's, I suppose, you know, when I was going into the senior school or whatever, St. Michael's College is a big rugby school. Mm. And, you know, I wanted to play rugby, obviously. That was never going to happen. But, you know, I remember, you know, my friends were all playing sport and, you know, I really wanted to get into sport. And the first sport that I tried was wheelchair rugby, you know.
I was actually thinking that when you said Blackrock and then St. Michael's.
Yeah, yeah.
Wheelchair rugby's ringing a bell here. Like, why didn't you not go down that avenue?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was the first one that I tried. And wheelchair rugby kind of made me realise, you know, that sport was definitely for me. But I was a very competitive person.
Yeah.
I didn't like losing and I wasn't good at wheelchair rugby, even though it was a lot of fun. You know, I couldn't bounce the ball and move the chair at the same time, you know, because I've only one arm. But I went to a summer camp in UCD with my brother and we tried out loads of different sports. And table tennis was the only one that I could beat him at. So that was that. I stuck at it from there. And, you know, obviously I love table tennis for many, many reasons. But like that was where it all began. You know, I remember that summer in UCD. I think I was only 11. So I started, you know, playing quite young for a Paralympic athlete. And since then I never looked back.
Tell us what school was like for you.
Yeah, school, like I said, the junior school, it was a bit of a breeze. I didn't really realise that I was different. And I was pretty happy with things. And
you know, was in the senior school then, kind of around the age of like 13, 14, you know, the difficult teenage years. Like my friends, you know, they not only started playing rugby and, you know, I didn't have a sport at that stage, but like, you know, they started going to parties and drinking beer, kissing girls. And, you know, I just felt completely left behind. And I think this was, you know, probably the most difficult time that I had dealing with my disability, because, you know, the only thing that a 13-year-old boy wants is to fit in. And yeah, when you've got one arm and no legs, it's a very difficult thing to do. And, you know, it was the scariest thing in the world, you know, back then. You know, the lads were going to Wesley, the disco there. And in Donnybrook, you know, they were there every Friday. And, you know, there'd be gaff parties on, you know, at the weekends. And, you know, I'd be never invited. And, you know, I got on very well with the lads. It wasn't that, you know, they were excluding me deliberately. But it was like, you know, they might have a few steps up to their house. So they think, oh, you know, or they might be unsure, you know, if I would want to be exposed to that sort of a thing. And, you know, for a couple of years, I was kind of excluded unintentionally, I would say. And, you know, I think that these were the most difficult years that I had dealing with my disability. But then obviously in that time, I started playing table tennis and, you know, I made good progress with that quickly. And I took it quite seriously, you know, from a young age. It obviously took me a very long time to get good, but it's a minority sport in Ireland. And, you know, I was able to compete quite well at my level in the wheelchair category, like in Dublin. And, you know, when I started winning matches, then I started get a bit of confidence and, you know, I set goals for myself and I'd reach the goals and, you know, that made me feel good. And, you know, I think that then, I suppose, translated into academics, like that, you know, my mum saw that I was doing so well in table tennis and, you know, she saw no reason why I couldn't, you know, do well in, at the books as well, and kind of came good around fifth and sixth year. I wasn't a great student up until then. I didn't really take it seriously. And yeah, I probably used my disability as an excuse, you know, as, you know, studying was difficult. Motivation was low, I suppose. And for a few years, I suppose table tennis was the main thing that I cared about. But yeah, I worked really hard for the Leaving Cert and, you know, managed to put in a good shift. And I remember, you know, being in transition year as well, speaking to my guidance counsellor and me telling him that I wanted to study actuarial and financial studies, which it was the most, the highest points course in the country at the time. I remember him looking at me like I had three heads, you know, like I was struggling with maths at this stage. You know, he was an Irish teacher and, you know, I was useless at Irish and I didn't get any better really. But, you know, I thought back to the time that the doctors, they told my parents that I wouldn't be able to do this and that. And I became determined to prove them wrong. And, you know, that was my big, big motivation. I think, you know, just to prove to people that, you know, I wasn't going to let my disability get in the way and that I could achieve. And, you know, yeah, thankfully I did get into the Aisne UCD and graduated 4 years later.
Yeah, it's actually mad when you're saying that. So like physically things are a challenge here and you let that then seep into your mental capacity because you are an academic. Like you graduated, you went on to become a data analyst then. Like,
yeah,
you won't just let anyone do that. Like, you know what I mean? No. That brain's born to be doing that.
Yeah, no, you need a lot of them. I don't think I have enough. It's a tough job.
But like it's mad the way you can let that. So it's like a mindset kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can be defeated before you even wake up kind of thing, or you can go and fucking and get after it. And do you think your competitive edge, now I don't want to speak on your behalf, so that's why I'm asking the question, do you think your competitive edge comes from the fact that every day is a challenge to you to go about your day and you then let that seep into your life and that's where you get the drive from?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm really obviously used to adversity and, you know, I'm used to struggles. And like, I think during my table tennis career, you know, I've suffered a lot of losses, which we'll talk a bit more about later on. But like, I'm so used to being disappointed and, you know, I'm very well used to, you know, fighting, you know, for everything that I have. And, you know, I think from a young age, I've kind of been desperate to prove, you know, to everybody, but also I think, you know, to my parents, like who've supported me so much and, you know, they've always been there. And I think they're a big reason why, you know, I've always tried to do the best I can in every area because they really gave me every opportunity. And, you know, that was why, like my mum especially was very much into the books. And, you know, I felt I owed it to them, you know, that I have to do my best here, you know. And yeah, she said, like, I had a brain like everybody else. They didn't have an excuse. And I made an excuse for myself up until that, you know, where I didn't really have one, you know. Like, I was capable to do the work and to But it's just very much in the head and how you look at these things. I think, you know, we make excuses for ourselves very easy. And yeah, I mean, I think the Leaving Cert is a good example. You know, a lot of people, how they find it difficult to study or whatever, but it is very much just good habits and hard work.
Mm. You spoke earlier about the exclusion from your friends in your early teen years. Do you think that kind of came from or stemmed from it being awkward to have a conversation around the disability, where they didn't want to make you feel awkward, or they felt awkward because it's kind of a tough topic?
It is a tough topic, and I think especially, you know, in Ireland, disability can be, it can be a difficult issue. And, you know, it wasn't kind of until they got to know me really very well. And I think it was kind of me that had to initiate a lot of the conversation, and me that had to nearly invite myself to the party, you know. Mm. Kind of around 15, 16, I was like, probably, yeah, in transition year, I was just like, come on, you know, why am I involved, you know? But if I hadn't have taken that step, no pun intended, you know, I don't think I ever would have, you know, gotten in with my friends and, you know, I started, you know, going to parties or whatever and talking to girls. That never would have happened had I not made the effort myself. You know, for a lot of people, it kind of just happened naturally. And I think that was the difficult thing. But I, you know, my friends never meant any harm. They just didn't really know how to.
So that's what I'm kind of saying. I'd obviously be thinking positively in that sense that they never meant harm from it, but it was probably an awkward kind of situation for them to be in.
A tough one, yeah. You know, because like I was never bullied in school. And obviously, like a lot of the lads were, you know, quite badly bullied, like in most schools, really. You know, I really was excluded from that. Like no one would ever, you know, say a bad word to the boy in the wheelchair, but like, yeah, no one would ever invite him to a party either. And, you know, this was kind of really difficult. I just wanted to be a normal teenager. And, you know, it wasn't really until sort of the end of secondary school, like transition year, probably at the earliest, where, you know, I kind of broke out and, you know, developed a bit of a personality. And, you know, it was then that, you know, the lads really just accepted me for who I was. And after then, you know, I was involved in everything and never looked back. Like, we still keep in touch today.
Class, yeah. Was it an active decision to change it to an able-bodied school, or was it a decision made that there was no spaces in another school? Or?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have to probably talk to my mum and dad a bit more about that. But I think they just wanted, you know, everything to be as normal as possible for me. My dad went to Blackrock College, so that's where they wanted to send me initially, but it wasn't wheelchair accessible at the time. So they chose Michaels, which are like, Michaels is like the rival of Blackrock College in rugby. But yeah, I mean, I think it was for that reason. They felt that I could cope, I suppose, in an able-bodied school, even though it was difficult at times. And, you know, maybe they felt that, you know, I would shoot for the stars a little bit in an able-bodied school. Like they would kind of bring me up to, you know, their level or whatever. Academically, obviously, Michaels and Blackrock are very strong, and, you know, they have a lot of sports and stuff. And, you know, maybe in a, I'm not really aware of, you know, schools for the disabled or whatever, maybe they wouldn't have the same facilities. But I think it was just very much that they saw me as a normal kid. And, you know, I was mentally normal. Obviously, this is probably the biggest reason. Like, I had physical challenges, but, you know, I had an SNA back then, and, you know, that I was able to be pretty independent, you know, pretty quickly. And I suppose for that reason, then, you know, they didn't need to send me to a different school. Like, it was Michael's. I was very lucky in my year in Michael's. Like I said, I was never bullied. I had a lot of great friends. I was very well supported. And yeah, it was tough at times, but I look back on it very fond memories.
Mm. You have this bulletproof mindset where,
yeah,
I think it would be very easy for someone in your position to have a victim's mentality and kind of sit back and struggle with life. And you seem to have this really strong mindset and determination of wanting to be normal and wanting to do well and check out yourself. Like, where do you think that comes from?
Yeah, well, I think, like I said earlier, like my mum and dad kind of ingrained it in my brain, like from a young age, like that, you know, the world wasn't going to stop for me, and that I was going to need to be independent someday. And they really believed that I could. And, you know, I made a lot of progress very quickly. And, you know, like I said, even as something as simple as leaving the shirt and tie out on the bed, like, because I know some kids these days, like, they get a lot of help from their parents for things that, you know, they're well able to do. And, you know, maybe, you know, had I had a carer or an SNA, which, like, you could definitely argue that I would have needed one back then, you know, maybe then I would have been a lot less independent, you know, because I suppose we kind of get very used to what, how do I phrase this? Like, you know, I suppose when you're used to, from a young age, being very independent, you kind of don't really know any other way.
Mm.
But I think it's dangerous then, you know, had I kind of received a lot of care at a young age and,
you'd become, you know,
people dressed me, yeah, and helped me maybe with the toilet and, you know, drove me to school, like, you know, things then you kind of, you get to a certain age, then suddenly you're 16, 17, 18, and you're not really doing any of those things. And then it's very, very difficult, I think.
Mm.
You know, when you've had them done your whole life, then, you know, I see, you know, there's a lot of guys on the tour, like, that have disabilities, and like a lot of them are really, really independent. And then, you know, some others are not. And, you know, I really think that it is education, and I'm just grateful that my parents from a young age, you know, they wanted me to be as independent as possible. And yeah, I'm very, very grateful to them for that.
Well, they've done a fucking great job with it, because if they could see that this was the plan for the future.
Yeah.
It's so difficult to see, isn't it? When you don't have any role model.
No, yeah. And it's a difficult conversation, definitely for them, to be like, right, you were the oldest, did you say? You would have.
This
is our first child. This is after being sprung on us. It wasn't, they didn't see this coming. The doctors didn't, so they weren't prepared for it. And then for them to sit down and be like, this is how we're going to raise our child, and that's it. And no doubt they would have seen you struggle at times. And for them to be like, right, we have to still stick to this. It's crazy. Like,
vision of making you the man that you are today is like Calvin is saying, like, for to be able to sit back and give that tough love and be like, let him struggle, because this is what will make him in the future. Yeah. And for this to make you the man you are today, this competitive, determined man is like, what a job on their end.
And you as well, you're so accepting of that. Like, you could easily sit here and resent them.
Yeah.
Like, they never give me this or that, or I struggle and I could have done with more help here. You're looking back at them and you're thanking them. Like, that's brilliant on all parties, on their part and on your part.
Mm.
And it's no doubt this is what has you in the position you are today. Mm. So we've gone through school, you get into college. Surely you're playing table tennis in college.
Everybody's big time. Yeah, I had a lot of time, you know. I didn't like going to lectures very much. So yeah. No, I really, I stepped it up definitely in college. You know, I'd made my international debut, I think, in Paris and France it was at this stage. And, you know, I kind of, at this stage, fancied myself as a pretty good player. Like,
if you want to actually take us back to, so when you first started playing table tennis, then, like, when do you get to a point where, like, because you're speaking now about being in college and then you're thinking internationally and stuff like that. So bring us on that kind of journey in table tennis.
From when you're first
playing to...
Like your first time representing Ireland.
Yeah, so like I said, I tried table tennis out in this summer camp with my brother. And I was able to beat him, but he probably wasn't a great table tennis player.
So you thank your brother for not being good at table tennis.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah, because even though I could beat him, it was very difficult. Like learning to play table tennis with one arm and no legs. Like it was, like I said, I was the only one in Ireland in my condition, and you know, table tennis was a minority sport. So you know, I mean, I think at the beginning, the coaches didn't really know what to do with me. Like, you know, the way it's like, how is this guy ever going to play table tennis at any sort of level? And you know, I think it was really difficult at the start. Like, I started in UCD, and I would have trained a lot in Blackrock College, in an able-bodied club, and so my peers would have passed me out pretty quickly. You know, despite my best efforts, you know, I would have trained a lot more than most of them, but like I just lost everybody. Like the kids my age, like I had no chance really at this stage. And, you know, that was very, very tough. And I think, you know, one of the first things that I learned about table tennis was that I was going to have to work harder than them, you know. It was as simple as that. I was at a big disadvantage, and I needed to make up for it somehow, you know. But I was so happy playing table tennis. I think this was the most important thing at this stage.
Yeah, and just to enjoy it.
Yeah, and if I've ever have kids, you know, I would hope that it's the same for them, you know, because you see a lot of people, they're not really enjoying, well, I don't know, what maybe they're doing it for winning, or they're doing it because their parents think that it's the right thing for them. But it certainly wasn't like that for me at all. My parents wouldn't have forced anything on me from a sporting point of view. But I just kept working at it, and I sort of developed my own unique style. I'm left-handed, obviously. Don't have much of a choice. It's a big advantage in table tennis, as it is in tennis. You guys might know, like to be left-handed. So, you know, this maybe gave me a little bit of a
game.
It's an advantage to be left-handed.
It's a big advantage.
Is it like being a southpaw in boxing?
maybe so. Yeah, I mean, like less than 10% of the population, I suppose, are left-handed. So therefore, left-handed are practicing with right-handed more than right-handed are practicing with left-handed.
Crossed my mind before.
Yeah, so I think this is a big advantage. I know, like an able-bodied table tennis and in para table tennis, like if you look at the top 20, I don't know how many left-handers are in the top 20, but there's a lot more than two.
Yeah,
you know, it's less than 10% is left-handed, so it's a big advantage. And you know, I think another reason I love table tennis was like it's such a complicated game. Like you really have to use your head, and you know that's one thing that I could do well. Yeah. You know, I could make up for my sort of lack of physical abilities by, you know, being cute and like developing different strategies and tactics. And you know, I think this was maybe a reason why I was drawn to table tennis and why I stuck with table tennis was because I really believed like I could use that. You know, I could be mentally strong, I could be clever with my training as well. And you know, I started playing with like unique rubbers and, you know, to try to gain every advantage that I could. But like, it was really just hard work and progress was really, really slow, like I said. And I remember I started playing able-bodied Leinster League one time. I remember one Monday night, like played absolutely terribly, like couldn't put a ball on the table. Yeah. But this woman came up to me after the match and she said, Colin, thank you so much. No idea what she was thanking me for, you know, but she went on to say that before her son and daughter saw me that they never wanted to get involved in sport, and now that she couldn't get them away from it. And like, I was absolutely blown away by that. And like, at this point, you know, I'd never thought like I could inspire, you know, two kids to play sport. And you know, it was that, I think, as well, that, you know, a lot of people were very kind to me, very supportive of me, and you know, they really felt that I could make a big impact. And you know, I think, you know, from that point onwards, I've always said that I, you know, I want to do my best for my country and, you know, for everyone who supported me and, you know, for the next generation. Like, I'm currently the only high performance para table tennis player, and I just really hope that I can pave the way for some of the kids in the future. And you know, hopefully they can, you know, maybe have more opportunity than I had at a young age, because it was very difficult, like growing up. Like, the system is a lot better now, but still has a long way to go.
Yeah, so that's what I was thinking. So when you were growing up, you said you're playing a lot of able-bodied matches. Is there no like options for you and other disabled athletes to play in table tennis? Or are you the only option you have to play, if you actually want to play table tennis, you have to play an able-bodied person growing up?
Yeah, well, I suppose like there's not that many like playing para table tennis or table tennis in a wheelchair. So like, I suppose if you're practicing 5 times a week, yeah, you definitely do need to play with able-bodied players. But like, there is a para squad now. There's para training camps every month, and we've got a good group, like maybe 35 people with disabilities playing table tennis. But like, there just wasn't enough wheelchair table tennis players like when I was growing up or whatever, and there was quite a few able-bodied players, especially in my club. And so, you know, I think that was another reason why I really liked table tennis, was because it was kind of like, it was a sport that I could play with no limits, you know. And like, it was pretty much just, there's only one rule on the serve, like that you're not allowed to serve wide to someone in a wheelchair. But after that, the rules are the exact same for para table tennis and able-bodied table tennis. So like, I really loved that I could, you know, beat able-bodied players and in table tennis. Like, you know, what, there's not many sports, I think, that, you know, that could happen, you know. Like at this stage, you know, I was obviously doing all right in Ireland, small pool, kind of fancied myself as a pretty good table tennis player, you know. And at this stage, I'd been to a few training camps in France and Germany and made friends with the French and the Germans. And I used to hate that they called me a tourist, you know, because I was from Ireland and Ireland didn't have any table tennis players and I had a bad technique. And I remember I was determined to prove them wrong in my first tournament in Paris in France. But unfortunately, I quickly learned there was a big difference between training and competition. I had a hell of a lot of work to do. Lost all my matches in style. Don't think I didn't win a set in my international debut. And I was absolutely blown away. Like, and I think my dad and I, we went to to visit the Eiffel Tower in the Champs-Élysées on day two of the tournament. So the Germans were proved right on this occasion. Mm. But I think, you know, the biggest thing that I took away from my my international debut was, you know, now I saw like guys in a wheelchair competing at a really high level in table tennis. And I'd never seen that really in Ireland. And this really kind of gave me a motivation and, you know, kind of made me realize like that, you know, if they could do it, why couldn't I?
And that's the level.
Yeah. I didn't really have a role model or anybody, you know, to look up to. I couldn't really relate to a lot of the able-bodied
guys.
Sometimes
you need to see somebody at that level. I can get there.
He's got a disability like me, you know, why can't I?
But as you were saying, you touched on the mother who came up to you about with two kids.
Yeah.
Who were like, you're inspiring them.
Yeah.
It just takes that little bit of motivation and spark.
So this, I think, is what I came away really excited. Like, I wasn't disappointed, really. It was my first tournament. Obviously, I had kind of higher hopes than losing on day one.
Well, you were realistic about it.
I knew I was, like, really young. I was, like, I don't know what age, 14 or something. I was really young making my international debut. And, you know, I knew I had a lot of years ahead of me. And, you know, I just went home and, you know, I learned a lot from, you know, being at these training camps. You know, I'm very lucky, like, that, you know, countries like the UK and France and Germany have been, you know, very good to me, like letting me train there or whatever. And, you know, I really learned a lot from them and kind of took that home with me to my my training and kind of structured in a different way. And I'd learn exercises and stuff and different ways to play. And, you know, I'd get better each time, but I suppose progress was really, really slow. Like, I spent the next few years like traveling all around the world, like trying to move up the ranks of international table tennis. And at this stage, I'd been to the London 2012 Olympics and Paralympics with my dad, and I was absolutely blown away by this. It's like, you know, if there was ever a time where, like, you know, I realized this is what I want to do, it was probably back then. You know, I really then saw like the top of the top playing table tennis and every other sport, and like the atmosphere was absolutely electric. And, you know, that was kind of my dream from that day, was to, you know, to play for Ireland, compete for Ireland in the Paralympics. And, you know, I remember then, like, it was coming up to the Rio Paralympic Games 4 years later, and I'd kind of, by that stage, had gotten a few results. I'd beaten some of the better players in the world, and I went to so many tournaments. You know, I was really lucky that, like, a lot of my family and my friends and, you know, the Table Tennis Ireland and stuff would have supported me a lot, because I wouldn't have been able to manage going. Traveling is really, really expensive. Like, and, you know, table tennis is a minority sport, like I said. And, like, it was really difficult trying to fund everything. And it was the only way to move up the rankings and to get better was basically to travel to other countries, play with better players. To be competing. And then it was around the Rio Paralympic Games that I finally found a bit of form, but unfortunately missed out on the Rio Paralympic Games by one place. So I was devastated at the time. You know, it wasn't my goal, I have to say. And at this stage, I was maybe just finished the Leaving Cert and I was going into actuary. Like, so it wasn't really my goal to, like, obviously I wanted to be there. Yeah. It wasn't my plan to qualify for the Rio Paralympics. I thought it was a bit premature maybe, but I kind of just got those good few results and I ended up missing, you know, really close. And, you know, I was really, really devastated at the time. You know, I kind of felt once again I was coming away with nothing, and, you know, all my hard work, and, you know, the Olympics only every 4 years, and it would be 5 years this time because it was postponed by a year. So I had a long time to wait. But, like, I suppose with a few weeks reflection, I realized I'd come on a really long way. I was like 17 in the world at this stage, and I was only like 18. And
Colin, you mentioned a couple of minutes ago about the coaching and tactical side of table tennis. Now, to me and most other people who have no insight into the sport, I said it's a minority sport, but that level of the game, what is that like tactically and for coaches? Because I think in football, we'd have an idea of what a football manager does. They motivate, they have to mount the field, and they have their own tactics and stuff like that. What's it like for table tennis?
Yeah, like, table tennis is massively tactic based. Like, that's probably one of the reasons why I loved it. And, you know, the coach is massively important for me. Like, I've had a lot of good coaches over the years, and I definitely wouldn't be anywhere near where I am today without them. Like, table tennis is such a technical sport. And, you know, I wasn't good technically. I think, you know, from a young age, it was probably a bit because of my disability or whatever. We weren't really sure of what, you know, what's the best way to play for me. But, you know, you can be working and working and working, but if your technique isn't good and, you know, the exercises aren't good and your plan isn't good, you're not really going to make very much progress, and that's where the coach comes in, you know. So like I really did need guidance. And, you know, it was kind of around this time, actually, you know, when I just missed Rio, you know, that I started working a lot with my coach. And, you know, the results then, I can take you on further. Like they started to improve significantly. And, you know, I owe that a lot to, you know, two coaches in particular.
Because I was just sitting here thinking about it after you said that. I was like, tactically, what could you be coming up with tactically in the sport? Because it kind of... On the eye, I suppose you can simplify everything in the world.
Yeah.
You think you're just hitting then.
If you have just hitting it over there, yeah. But I think in, you know, in power table tennis and in wheelchair table tennis, it's even more.
This is what I was thinking,
you know?
Yeah.
You got people have like disabilities, like some people have a weak forehand because they can't leverage their weight properly.
And
or,
are
you
trying
know,
to expose that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, if someone is not moving very well, well, you're going to play very short, like on the table. And you know, the way, if they don't have a good reach, then this is even better, you know?
Yeah.
So it's massive. Like the able body, you know, they're obviously pretty able. Tactics is still very, very important, but in para, it's just...
It's like chess.
It's the only way to win, it is. Yeah. It's like chess at 100 miles an hour.
Yeah.
You know?
I love how ruthless you are. You're just like, it's so competitive. It's just, you have that like top performing elite athlete mindset of being like, I'm winning and I don't give a fuck about anybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the way you have to be.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
You know, you don't get anywhere being a nice guy. You know, I realized that pretty quickly, like, you know.
Yeah. So you... Reset the goals then to Tokyo 2020.
Yeah.
What's that journey like?
Yeah, so it started pretty well, I would say. There was definitely a lot of bumps on the road, which I'll go into now in a few minutes. But I suppose after missing the Rio Paralympic Games, there's like a major every year, like in para table tennis. So like it would go Olympics, Europeans, World Championships, Europeans, and then Olympics again. So there's a big, big major every year. And so I had my sights set on European Championships, which was to be a year later. And at this stage, I got a new coach, Gavin Maguire, and we started working a lot together. And we would have like had, you know, three or four one-to-ones every week. And, you know, I hadn't really worked so much, like so specifically, I suppose, with a coach at this stage. But like, again, I was very lucky, like Table Tennis Ireland and Paralympics Ireland. They saw that I just missed Rio and that I had some good results. I beat some of the top players in the world, and now they were going to, you know, start funding a coach for me. And, you know, Gav Maguire was Irish number one, I think, at the time. And, you know, I kind of knew him from my club. He was an able-bodied player. And I suppose his kind of professionalism and, you know, I took a lot from that. And obviously just playing with someone of such a high level, and he would have used to play in the chair, which was like kind of made it the closest thing that I could have to, you know, playing with someone in a wheelchair. And I think it was, you know, it was then that I really started to get big results. And, you know, I remember our first two tournaments together, I actually won the Spanish Open and the German Open. And I'd only won one tournament, I think, prior to this back in 2014. It was a weaker tournament in Romania. But these were like two big events, and I beat some very good players to win. We had our sights set on the European Championships, and you know, I knew the European Championships was going to be a big step up. There was going to be a lot of pressure, and you know, no Irish athlete had ever won the European Championships before, and I wanted to be the first one. And I remember the tournament came around, I trained really, really hard the whole summer, like sacrificed my whole summer, missed the lads' trip to EOS for it. You know, I gave up everything. I went to every training camp that I could. I was in Sheffield, I was in Slovakia, I was in Serbia, all over the place, like trying to get as much practice as I could, and obviously working a lot with Gav. And my campaign got off to an absolutely disastrous start. I lost to one of the lowest ranked players in the tournament, which was just...
Why do you think that happened?
Wasn't your day?
Pressure. Well, it definitely wasn't my day. Mm. But I suppose, like, up until then, I felt like I was chasing something. You know, I didn't really have anything to prove. And now I felt like I was a good player and it was kind of mine to lose. And I was looking at it the wrong way. Like, I was kind of been quite protective of what I have. And the second that the mindset shifts and you're starting to protect what you have, protect your position. I'm happy now. I'm ranked whatever, fifth in the world or ninth in the world or whatever I was. You know, that's when things catch up with you. And I think it was probably just the occasion as well. I was playing in a really big hall and there was a decent sized crowd, which I'm definitely not used to playing table tennis in Ireland. Okay. There's usually only a few people looking at me. But, you know, I went back to my hotel room after that match and cried my eyes out, and that's not something that I normally do. You know, even with everything I've been through with my disability, like just once again, like felt like I'd put my heart and soul into this and came away once again with nothing. Because like, as far as I was concerned, like the tournament was over now. Like I lost to some lad, he's only picked up the racket, like, you know, the way I was out of the group now. I had to win my next two matches 3-0, 3-0 against two players that I'd never beaten. So like I was as good as out. But luckily for me then, my coach gave me a talk, and you know, he said I've got to just forget about all the expectation on me, go out and enjoy the experience and be grateful for the opportunity to play for your country when there's so many back home that would love to be there. And it was like a weight had been lifted off my shoulders. I didn't look back after that, and I really just, like he said, then I just played away practice and let the results take care of themselves. I really just focused on my performance, and I was lucky enough to win those next two matches 3-0, miraculously, like never beaten either of the players. And in table tennis, it's best of five. So I had to basically not drop any sets. So I had to win 3-0, 3-0. So like, and I didn't win too many matches 3-0 at this stage at all. I still don't.
Imagine, where do you pull
not
that
easy
from?
To win 3-0, like, yeah. You know, the way. But it was just like, I felt it was over now. I'm just doing this for pride, like, and you know, I'll try and win one match maybe and just show people that I'm a decent player, but I'm not gonna win anymore. It's amazing, like, when you forget about the winning and the result and all of that, like what you can do. Mm-hmm. And I just went from strength to strength after that. I got out of the group and I was in last 16, quarterfinal, semifinal and final. And, you know, next thing I knew, I was in the final and I was 2-0 up. Like I was on the home stretch. And I remember then I was playing this Polish guy in the final, and he pulled one back then. It was 2-1, and I think he was number two in the world at the stage. And I was really, really, really nervous then. I really didn't think I could pull through. And, you know, I was just, I think at this stage, it's just, you know, you're really, really nervous. And it's very much then the training, I think, that you put in. You really just fall back to that. You definitely, well, I don't rise to the occasion. I kind of fall to the standards that I set in practice. And, you know, luckily for me, me and Gav had done a lot of good work, and I managed to scrape over the line, and that's really what it was. And
it's unbelievable. That, do you think focusing on winning too much is a setback?
Massively. Yeah, this was something I was really guilty of, you know, when I was younger especially. Like, obviously it can still happen today, like we're all human at the end of the day, but like, you have to focus on performing at your best. Like, you can't really, like, you can't control the result. And I think when you're playing at a high level, like, you realize it even more, that like, you just can't afford to be protective of what you have, or think that because your ranking is good that you're going to beat this guy.
Mm.
You know, because this is the way I would have thought back then. You know, it's like, he's number 37, I'm number 9. Like, I just have to go in and kind of go through the motions here and I'll get the job done. But it's not the case at all. And, you know, the level has obviously come on a massive amount since, like, in the last 10 years, you know, from when I first started playing. It's become a lot more professional, and there's a lot more money in para table tennis internationally, and you know, everyone's taking it really seriously. So you can't afford to stand still again.
Have you done much work with a sports psychologist? Because although you keep saying that you have a normal brain like everybody else and you use that to your advantage, so if you got a bit of confidence, that can really propel you, but if you got a bit of doubt, that can really hold you back. Have you done much work on the psychology of a sport athlete?
Yeah, so I would have worked a lot with a sports psychologist at this point, because I suppose this was the time when I missed Rio. Like, I would have started to become a lot more professional. I was being supported by Paralympics Ireland, and you know, they were funding like a physio, a nutritionist, a psychologist. So I got all these services, and you know, they all helped me like a huge amount. And psychology is just like, it's massive in table tennis. Like, the head, like, if you can have the best technique in the world and you can have all the shots, but if like you can't put it together and you can't execute when you're under pressure, like, it's not much use to you, really. Like, you know, I see so many players in that boat, by the way, that are, you know, better players like than me, like, and they just can't execute on the day. So it's absolutely massive in table tennis. Like, I think that I've a good strong mental, like, from so many losses and so many setbacks. And I think with my disability coming up from a young age, like, and obviously a lot of the para athletes are in a similar boat, like, I've struggled against adversity a lot. And you know, I'm well used to losing. And, you know, now I think when I go into a match, like I'm just expecting it to be in the fifth set. Like I'm ready for that, you know. But I think it's, you know, the exposure that I got and the experience, I just sort of got better with that over time. I really, really struggled and was really, really nervous at back in the day. And I still, like, obviously I'm nervous when I compete, but I'm just able to manage it a lot better now and sort of channel those energies in a positive way.
Brilliant. You win the European Championship.
Yeah, you know, hearing the Irish national anthem in a table tennis hall is something that I'll never forget. You know, it was absolutely incredible. Seeing the Irish flag as well, big flag sitting on the podium. You know, I think this has to be maybe the best, if definitely one of them, the best moments of my career. And I think it's a big reason why, you know, I'm still playing, is like, it's a feeling that I desperately want to replicate. Like, this is probably my top medal, like the best medal that I've won, is winning the European Championships. And, you know, I always look back on this, like, because it was so unexpected at the time. You know, I was from Ireland and, you know, I'd never beaten a lot of the top players. And I think I was ranked 17 in the world. And, like, I was so far off a lot of the top guys, and I just managed to pull it off. And, you know, it really gave me a lot of confidence going forward. And, you know, after obviously the European Championships, then I started getting offers from table tennis clubs and getting sponsorship for the first time ever, and my funding went up. And
is there money in the sport, Colin?
Not a huge amount. No. Yeah. It's a minority sport, like I said. But I suppose the money thing that I meant, I was able now to cover my costs myself. And, like, this was a big thing for me, like, because at this stage I wasn't working and, you know, I had college and, you know, I was trying to help my parents with that as well. And, like, it was just, it's very difficult to travel all around the world, especially if you've got a coach as well. And I was just kind of happy now that I was able to fund this myself. So I suppose you could say, like, things were pretty good after the European Championships. Yeah. I was pretty happy with myself. At this stage, I'd got into ACTRI and UCD, and so things were going very well there as well. But unfortunately, the good times didn't last long for me at all. And just to give you guys a bit of perspective on Paralympics and classification, so I know you guys are big fans of boxing, so the best way that I can describe it is like the weight classes in boxing. You've got disability classes in Paralympics, and so table tennis is classified on the severity of your disability, and the wheelchair table tennis classes go from 1 to 5, 1 being the most physically disabled and 5 being the least physically disabled in the wheelchair. And I was classified into class 2 at the age of 12 and presumed that it was something that was never going to change. But nothing could have prepared me and Gav for what the doctors told us on that day, like that they said, we're sorry, we're going to have to move you up into class 3. And, you know, I just won the European Championships and, like,
Is that common?
It's definitely not common. No, especially not for someone who was born with their disability. You know, one arm and no legs. It's not as if I grew an arm, like, after winning the European Championships, you know, because that's what it felt like. You know, I knew what it meant immediately. I was going to be competing against athletes that were considerably physically stronger than me, the majority. You know, I was going to lose a lot of my funding, was going to lose my ranking. And worst of all, my qualification hopes for Tokyo 2020 were seriously in jeopardy now. I think I was, you know, after winning the European Championships, I went to 5th in the world, and, you know, I went then 36 in the world in class 3. So, like,
how did they come to that decision?
That's a very good question. I still don't really understand it. It's very, very tough. I suppose they, like, the reasons that they gave me was that I was young and I was strong and, like, I was plenty able for class 3. But, like, you know, from my point of view, I'd worked really, really hard for 10 years to win the European Championships, and I was the first one to do it for Ireland. And it just felt like they were, you know, throwing me out. I was very bitter about
it. Would you appeal it?
At the time, I did appeal it. It was rejected. So I was basically stuck in class 3 now. And, you know, it's one of the most difficult things that I've ever had to deal with, I would say. And, you know, a lot of people laugh at that when I say everything that I've been through with my disability. But, like, table tennis was my thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was 5th in the world and I was European champion. And, you know, that was me. You know, I'd worked really hard for this and it was my greatest achievement. And now it just felt like nothing now.
And where did you drop it? Did you say 36?
36, like, so, like, journeyman player, way off.
It's like starting qualifications.
All over again. Not quite starting all over again, but, you know, you're well outside the mix, you know, for Paralympic qualification, which is obviously what I had my sights set on. And it was really, really tough. I mean, dealing with that, I suffered many, many losses then, like nearly more losses than I did when I first started, you know, and it was nearly like starting again. Like I suppose I was a big fish in a small pond in class two. And then, you know, suddenly it was like when I'd made my international debut, suddenly I was just, you know, I wasn't one of the best anymore. I was way off, you know, and I just had to go back to the drawing board and completely change how I do things. And, you know, me and Gav then, we were still working together, and like we had to think of new ways to do things. We had to find a way to become better. And, you know, I think that's the best thing that's come out of my reclassification, was like, I've become a better player because of it.
Yeah, but I don't even understand how you pulled yourself out of there mentally.
That was, like, it was really, really tough. Like, and I, like I said, not even anything really in my, like in my childhood or younger years kind of prepared me for that. Like, because, you know, when I was young and I was playing table tennis or whatever, and I was going to parties the first time, I didn't really have much, you know, and anything that I achieved was a bonus. If I won a match against an old fella in the Leinster League, it was a massive achievement, you know, but at this stage, you know, I'd become European champion, and, you know, I just felt that they were taking it away from me, and this was really, really tough. It's different, you know, when you don't have something and you're trying to get it, but when you do have it and it's taken it's away taken from away, you, and you, yeah, you're suddenly nowhere near European champion level. Like,
but
like,
it's so easy then to throw the towel in.
It's easy to give up then, yeah. And I think it's only because my love for the sport is the reason that I didn't give in.
Could nearly draw comparisons with, as you said, when you were growing up, you'd never felt disabled until you became a teenager. Is that what it's like then going into the new class?
Into class three, yeah. Everyone's got their second arm and they're moving around, you know? They're leveraging their weight on the wheelchair, like, and they're much stronger, they're much faster.
Yeah.
Like, it was like that, and I suppose that's the best thing that I'm used to competing against able-bodied players, and obviously, you know, these guys are still in wheelchairs. But I suppose when you're just competing directly against someone and, you know, they've got two arms and they're moving the wheelchair, like, you're at an enormous disadvantage, you know, the way. But I really just had to go back to the drawing board and really think about my style. And now suddenly, you know, what I did in class two, which was kind of a very defensive game, like, I suddenly had to be a lot more active, a lot more aggressive, because I just suddenly wasn't good enough to be overly defensive in the new class, like, because they could just hit right through me, or they could really expose me in the wide corners in a way that, like, a class two player couldn't. And so I really had to up my training then. And it was at this point I was working as an actuary in KPMG. And, you know, I think, you know, maybe if I'd stayed in class two, I was kind of maybe able to continue working and, you know,
be comfy.
Comfy, yeah. And, you know, that's, I'm glad that I didn't. That's another, I suppose, advantage of the classification, because if I'd gotten too comfortable in class two, I'm sure that I would have dropped down the rankings, because that's the last things that I needed to do was get comfortable and, you know, forget how I got there in the first place. And yeah, so at this point, I'd made the decision then to leave my job as an actuary in KPMG, because I just felt like I was never going to reach my potential in table tennis, whatever that may be. I was never going to be competitive in class three if I didn't work at this full time. I certainly wasn't going to qualify for the Paralympics if I kept working whatever it was, 8, 9, 10 hours a day and studying on top of that, and then practicing a bit when I was very, very tired in the evening, you know, when I didn't feel like playing. I just knew that this wasn't the way, and that I needed to move over and play for a club in Germany. And, you know, I moved over for a few months, play with one of my best mates in Slovakia. He's in a wheelchair as well, class four. And, you know, we trained together every day. And, you know, this was the only way that I was going to become better, which is what I needed to do in a very short period of time. You know, the timing of this was awful. Like, it was 2018, you know, 2019 was like the big year for qualification. And, like, I just had so much work to do. I needed to start traveling again. You know, I was a bit selective with the tournaments up until this point, but we had to completely change our plan, and it was really, really tough. And like I said, I just gave it everything, and I didn't reach a lot of the goals that I set out for myself, but COVID probably worked in my favour a little bit this time. It postponed the games by 1 year, and I desperately needed the time. You know, that's maybe a little bit of a selfish thing to say, like, because obviously it destroyed so many people's games and their training and their plans, but you know,
fuck them.
Exactly. You have to be selfish about these things, and you know, I just just been thrown in the deep end, and you know, I was learning how to swim again, and you know, I just didn't have enough time to become good enough to qualify for a Paralympics. Like, I just wouldn't have had any chance to qualify. So that extra year, you know, gave me a chance to work with Gav and to train in Slovakia and play a few more events, even though there wasn't that many because they were all cancelled because of COVID. Thankfully, I once again did manage to scrape over the line and I qualified for my first Paralympics. I was given a wild card. I'd lost in the semi-finals of the last chance qualifier. I'd come very close on the ranking though, so I knew like the wild cards are kind of extra slots basically, and you have a certain criteria to meet, and I was the only Irish athlete and I was probably the next on the ranking list, and so I was a nervous 6 weeks. Like, you'd no idea basically whether you were going to be picked or not.
Yeah.
And thankfully, when I got the call, I think that was the best day of my life, and it was really late. Like, at this stage, like, you're thinking, no chance, like, it's July, the games are next month, like, yeah, unbelievable. So I had about 6 weeks to prepare for the Tokyo Paralympics, and obviously preparations were very weird. Like, the restrictions were quite stringent here in Ireland. You couldn't really practice, you know, that much or that easily, and it was a really, really weird one. Like, it just came so quickly, qualifying for Tokyo, but you know, it's an experience that I'll never forget, like competing for Ireland and Tokyo. And I was the only Irish table tennis player and went over there with Gav and the rest of the team, which was amazing. You know, I kind of, a lot of the time at that stage, you know, we didn't have much of a team. And so I loved, you know, getting to know the swimmers and the athletics and the cycling and the other minority sports. And it was a great atmosphere in the camp. You know, we went out to Japan a couple of weeks early, you know, to acclimatise and train and get ready. And it had been a bit rushed. Like, I didn't, you know, feel fully prepared, obviously, for the games. I wasn't even sure if I was going to be there. And I was still only really getting to know the players in my class. I hadn't played a lot of them, but I was working really hard, like, at that stage and doing everything that I could. And, you know, next thing I knew, I was in the Olympic Village and it's in Tokyo. Absolutely unbelievable. Like, and you see then kind of athletes from every corner of the earth, like, you know, competing at the highest level. And, you know, that's a dream for me. I'm lucky, like, to have been all over the world and very grateful, like, to have seen so much. But there's not much, I'd say, that compares to what I seen in the Paralympic Village. Like, I remember it was kind of like been back in my international debut. I remember going to the food hall, which you might have heard, like, massive, Olympic Village, big massive thing.
Yeah.
See this Egyptian lad, and he's eating his dinner with his legs, like, he's got his cutlery and the toes, feet up on the table, you know. And it's just like, you know, you think, yeah, I think I have it tough sometimes, but like, it's just incredible, you know. So it was a dream, like, getting to know all those people and just seeing, you know, all of those guys compete at the top level on their sport. And probably I got carried away a little bit with it all, like, just the atmosphere. I was just so new to me. And, you know, the event came around then, and unfortunately I was drawn against China, which is not the country that you want to be playing
against. A cube.
yeah, exactly. Probably worse. China, it is their national sport and they basically don't lose in table tennis. So it wasn't really the draw that I wanted. But, you know, I suppose once again, I had nothing to lose. I just wanted to go out there and put in a good performance. I was probably disappointed with my performance, to be honest. I lost 3-1 in my first match. It was a group game to the Chinese. And then I had another match against a Brazilian guy the next day. And then something absolutely incredible happened. The Brazilian lad failed a drug test and I was given a bye.
So I wanted to ask about this, but I was like, am I being disrespectful asking, is there much doping in?
No, there definitely is not. It was the most bizarre thing ever. You go to the call area and it's like you're home and dry. You don't have to take your jacket off. Like, unbelievable stuff. Like, you know, I was really pumped up for this match. Like, okay, I lost to China, but I felt, all right, I have a chance against this Brazilian fella. And he just, didn't turn up. And suddenly I was into the last 14.
Brilliant. Look, we'll take it.
We'll take it. Absolutely. Yeah, exactly.
You should
have back to Brazil with you.
So what's the next match then?
So it's against Russia.
Right, so that strikes me as like not being too far away from China.
Yeah, it is. This was a really tough one again. Like, he's the lad who actually knocked me out of the qualifier. So he won the last position basically to qualify for the games, and was a really, really tough match. And he's a very, very vocal character, this guy. He's really, really in your face, like a tough, tough competitor. Really, really hard match. And it was a really, really tough one. It was a lot closer this time, but once again, I didn't manage to get over the line. He was just too strong, too fast, and I just didn't have enough in the tank really to get over the line. And I was really, really disappointed. Like at this stage, I felt like I got through the group, you know, maybe there's a chance to get into the quarterfinals and I could fight for a medal. I would have had one of my best mates in the quarterfinals. And, you know, we had many, many good matches at this stage over the years. He was a better player than me, but I kind of felt like if I just could get through this one that I really did have a chance at a medal.
Mm.
But it wasn't to be. And, you know, that was really, really tough. But I think, you know, the disappointment then coming back to my room or whatever in the Olympic Village, and it was a bit of a downer buzz, like, because, you know, COVID was rampant at this stage and
you couldn't go out,
like you couldn't enjoy Tokyo, which I've heard is a great place. And, you know, we actually had to get the flight a couple of days later, so we didn't really get to take in much of the atmosphere. So it was a tough time. It was a disappointment. And look, it made me realize that I don't want to be losing. I don't want to be knocked out in the early stages of a tournament again. And, you know, I was disappointed. I went home, and I suppose, again, with a few weeks reflection, I was really, really grateful to have been there and, you know, to have gotten that experience under my belt. Obviously didn't want to lose the way I did. But, you know, I suppose it just hit home to me, like, that this is where I wanted to be, you know, with these guys, like, with every disability that you can imagine, like, you know, competing at such a high level, like, this is where I wanted to be.
Mm.
I felt like at home there. And, you know, I just wanted to, my focus shift down to Paris 24. And that really motivated me, you know, I didn't want a games like that. I surely didn't want, you know, my parents to, because obviously my parents weren't in Paris 24. There was no crowds. So like, it was a bit flat from that point of view. But Paris 2024 now, you know, just I felt at that stage, it was my goal from then. And it's obviously my goal now. And, you know, I didn't want there to be a big crowd and, you know, me to not perform my best. And, you know, that's really given me, you know, the motivation. Like, I've got another chance now, and I'm going to make the most of it. I don't know what the result will be. I can't control that, but I'm going to leave no stone unturned, and I'm going to, you know, do everything I can to be, you know, the best version of me and give myself the best chance.
Brilliant. You come home from Tokyo, though, and you go back walking.
I did, yeah. So I kind of had a bit of, post-Olympic Games, Paralympic Games blues. Like, it's kind of a bit of an anti-climax. Like, you come home and then suddenly now there's no tournaments for ages. And it's, you know, we're not going to say the Olympic and Paralympic athletes are forgotten about for 4 years, but like, it's a quiet period, I would say, in the calendar. And, you know, there's not much training. Like, you know, I wouldn't have had many sessions. And, you know, at this point, I decided that I'd go back to work, and I did for a little while. But then once again, once the tournaments came around, and I felt that I wasn't giving it my all, it was goodbye to the job again, and back full time. You know, when the competition schedule got busy, and, you know, a lot of training camps, I just couldn't get the time off. I couldn't keep all the balls in the air. And I suppose at the end of the day, table tennis was what I wanted to do. I wanted to reach my best level, and I didn't want to have any regrets. And that's just the first thing that I thought that I would have if I was, you know, working full time. You know, none of the best players at the top of Paralympics or Olympics are working at all, or definitely not full time. You have to, being an athlete is a full time thing. You have to give it everything, otherwise you're left behind now. And so I made the decision to leave my job, you know, which was, once again, it was a tough decision. Because this time I was in the new class, and, you know, I'd made a little bit of progress, but like, I still was a long way off, you know, where I was in class two. So like, it was still a tough decision. I wasn't making much money at all, like, you know, compared to what I was in class two, which wasn't a huge amount, but I was able to cover my expenses. And, you know, I'd made money like working as an actuary or working in data analytics. And I was living at home at that stage, so I'd saved up money, and, you know, I was just wanted to invest that in table tennis and in one-to-one training sessions, and in going away to training camps and going away to tournaments. And once again, it was like me trying to climb up the ranks. This time it was a lot more competitive, and there was a lot of dark days and a lot of frustration. And I had a European Championships directly after competing in Tokyo, and this was once again very disappointing. I lost in the group, which I'd won the European Championships the last time I played. So like, that puts it in perspective. I basically didn't get anywhere in this one.
This is in the new class, though.
This is in the new class, yeah. But it's basically the European Championships 2 years on, so the next one. And really, really tough. And so, yeah, that came and went. And I think it was at this point, and I'm getting very confused with the years here at this stage, that I started.
COVID done that to everybody.
yeah.
All struggling.
But it was at this point that my new coach, Sam Logue, took over, and I started working with him. And it was really, really different at the start. You know, I'd been working with Gav for, I think, 4 or 5 years, like, and we'd obviously worked a huge amount together. And just, you know, starting to play and starting to train with someone new, it was really, really different at the start. And like, Gav and Sam had their different ways, and took me a little while to get used to Sam's ways. Sam is very much a stickler for technique, which, you know, I didn't really have a good technique, but I needed to. And, you know, I remember being a bit frustrated at the start, like, he kept stopping me in the middle of the training. And, you know, I just look back on that now, and I'm very grateful to him for it, because I just hadn't focused on my technique enough, like, up to this point, and it's needed to become better. Like, I was obviously at a big disadvantage physically, and I really needed to use everything that I've got, and I didn't really do that in the most efficient way at the time. And, you know, I think it's one of the, there's obviously a lot of good things that Sam has brought, but that's, I think, the first one that I can think of when we initially started working together. He was really focused on my technique, and kind of was a slow process. Like, we focus on, like, smaller things, more simple things, you know, that I thought that I was good at, but, like, I quickly realized that I wasn't that good at it. Like, you kind of think, like, because you can play a match at a high level, that you can play, you know, backhand, middle, backhand, forehand very well, and I can play it over and over again, but I actually couldn't do it at the time. And, you know, Sam and I, we've got a really, really good relationship. We've come a long way together. I think we've been working together 2 years now, but we work an awful lot together. And, you know, I would say last year, 2023, it was my best year ever, I would say, in terms of results. Like, obviously, I won the European Championships before. But
up in the new class,
yeah. And I beat some of the best players in the world. I've beaten, I think, 3 in the top 8. I was on the podium again at the European Championships, which was special. Class. Absolutely unbelievable. Like, and, you know, I really owe, I think, a lot to Sam for my success last year. He's obviously in my corner as well. This is massive, having someone. Sometimes, you know, when you're in the heat of the moment, you can't really see the wood from the trees, you know?
Yeah.
You think you're doing something and you're not really doing it at all, and you watch it back. And we kind of work together a lot. We've been to a lot of events together at this stage, and we just really, really clicked. Like, it was kind of in the second half of last year. Had a lot of good results. And then in the European Championships, 3rd. And like I said, beat 3 of the top 8.
Yeah,
on my way. And that's made me 9th in the world now.
Unbelievable.
Which we've come a long way. Yeah. And it's the biggest class, class 3 in Paralympics table tennis. So it's the toughest class. There's the most good players. The number 1 and number 2 in class 3 are the top 2 in men's wheelchair. And it's really, really tough classification, really complicated, lots of different styles, which, you know, Sam's really good at playing, like, lots of different styles, which is what I need. Because obviously I don't get exposed to that very much, like playing a lot of able-bodied, it's just a completely different game. Even though it's still table tennis, they play in a different way.
Yeah.
And we've worked a lot on this and, you know, preparing for specific opponents. And it's really worked very well. We've had a sort of a long training period now since November. We kind of would have been going to a lot of events in January and February had I been in a panic for qualification. But luckily, my qualification it's not set in stone yet, but I'm in a strong position. And now I'm going to start competing next week for the first time this year. Mm. And then it's going to be quite busy. I'm going to have a lot of events, like, between now and the games. I'm going to start my event on the 1st of September in Paris 2024, if all goes to plan. And yeah, I'm just really, really excited to, I really miss competing, I would say, because I had a lot of it last year and I did well. Yeah. And it's, yeah, winning is like a drug. It's kind of like, now I remember it back in the old class when I was winning matches, and now I really feel like I can mix it with the best.
Got the bug again class. Now.
Yeah.
When you were 36th at the get moved into class, right, did you imagine that you'd get to the top 10?
Absolutely not. No, I mean, like, to be honest, if I'm really brutally honest, like, I think my plan was just to continue playing, was because I like playing.
I love and, event,
you know, maybe I might get another wild card because I was the best from Ireland. Like, and this was not a good way to think of it, but this is the only way that I could, because I never really believed that I could even get it this far and mix it with the best.
Yeah.
I was kind of nearly hoping for, like, a token ticket to the games, like, but, you know, I'm just so happy now that I've earned it and that I've qualified. More, I'm not going to say that yet because the deadline is March.
Yeah.
But I'm in a strong position to qualify, and yeah, it's a good feeling.
One thing that it's been evident from speaking to you today, Colin, is that you've always kind of had the choice to have, like, a safer option.
Mm.
And even there, when you were like, "Oh, I just hoping I could have got a wild card," but you're like, "No, fuck that." And you're driving on now, you're 9th in the world. So, like, no matter what, you're just ruthless about it. Like, yeah, I could settle for that, but I'm not. I'm pushing this through and I'm driving it. A as far as it'll go. You mentioned there earlier on, there's no money in it. So what's the funding like in terms of someone in your position?
Yeah, I mean, it's been really tough over the years is what I would say. I'm obviously in a good position now, having more or less qualified for the games, and I'm on high performance funding, so I'm kind of well able to cover my costs. But I suppose, like, from a development point of view in table tennis, like, we've got a decent sized development team and a pathway team now, and funding is just really, really difficult. I mean, like, the criteria for table tennis is very, very, very difficult. Like, to reach even the minimum level of funding, you have to be like top 12 in the world, which is like, that took me years and years and years to become top 12. And, you know, I had to go to loads of events, and like, I was just lucky that people fundraised for me, and, you know, Paralympics Ireland saw a bit of potential in me and Table Tennis Ireland. And, you know, I managed to get a lot of exposure and go to a lot of events and eventually win some matches. But it is really, really difficult. Like, it's expensive training one-to-one. I'd probably like to be training more, you know, with my coach. I'd probably look like I'd want to go to more training camps ideally, but like, and I'd want to maybe play more events. But like, the budget is tight. Even in Olympic year, there's not that much money. There's other players as well. Me and Sam work together 3 days a week, like, or sorry, 2 days a week. We'd probably want to work more together, you know, if we could. But it's just difficult in Ireland. Like, even getting a venue, I play a little bit in St. Pat's CY in Ringsend. The lads are very good to me down there. Give them a little bit of a shout out here. We train there like half time, and I also train in Blanchardstown, the sports campus. But like, it's really, really expensive, particularly in Blanchardstown, you know, in the indoor arena. Like, I'm ninth in the world, like I said, and like, we're paying through the nose to play in, you know, in our national centre, which is, it's unbelievable, really. Like, it's very, very difficult. And, you know, we don't know how long we can keep that up. Obviously, for the Olympic year now, we will continue to do it. It's a really good environment, and it's good training there. But like, it's all money at the end of the day. Like, and it's just really, really tough. And yeah, I've had to obviously give up my job. I'm not really making a huge amount of money in table tennis. I do a lot of talks for companies and for schools, and like, that would be my main source of income. They're quite sporadic, I would say, like, doing talks. I did really well up to Christmas then, but like, this is so far this year, there's not that many talks, like, so I'm really like looking for talks and looking for opportunities all the time. And that's once again why I really appreciate what you guys having me on, like, and, you know, sharing my story. It's a passion of mine, I would say, but like, that's like my main source of income at the moment. And I'm kind of just, I've got a few months to the games, and, you know, I'm not really looking beyond Paris. But I suppose when you look at the 4 year cycle, yeah, it's really difficult to fund, even for a high performance athlete like me. But I really do think of, you know, the lads coming up behind me as well, like, how difficult it is for them. They got to pay for every tournament, you know, 100%. And, you know, I really want to have teammates. I have more teammates now than I ever did. But like, you know, you want to give them an opportunity as well. How are we ever going to get any medals, like, if we only, you know, support one athlete, or, you know, everyone goes to the top? You know, I probably need it less than they do. And, you know, I just wish that there was kind of more money in the grassroots and in the development of table tennis. This is the only way that we can really, you know, perform, you know, our best in the big tournaments, you know.
Did you mention that you had a GoFundMe?
Yeah, I have a GoFundMe in my Instagram. And I, like I said, for Tokyo, like, I couldn't have done it without, you know, everyone been so generous with their donations, because like, I had to travel so much when I was reclassified. I had to go to every tournament under the sun, and like, it was really, really difficult. So yeah, I mean, I'm always grateful for support, like, however small. Like, it really does go a long way in helping me on my way to Paris, and, you know, hopefully winning that first, I'm not sure if it's the first, but it's the first singles medal anyway in Paralympics in table tennis. And that's my dream.
So when you listen to this, go onto his Instagram, go onto the GoFundMe. No matter how big or small, donate something.
Or share it as well.
Colin George 100.
Colin George 100. Go onto it and support him. You're an absolute legend.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, lads.
I really appreciate it.
Been very inspiring, Colin. Honestly, it's some serious mindset you have there. You ready to wrap this one up, Teddy?
Yeah.
Right, take yourself, Siobhan.
Boom.
Subscribe to this podcast for free on the Go Loud app. What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your whip in the door. Fill your body up. Work it hard and slow. When you finish that.
The Hypnoka. Go down. Go down. Go down.